Welcome to Best Movies Never Made, the podcast where we explore interesting and infamous movies that never made it to or through production. I am your co-host, Josh Miller, and with me, as always, is Mr. Steven Scarlatta.
How you doing today, Josh?
I'm doing pretty good, Steve. How about you?
Fantastic.
We are joined once again by our previous guest, Mr. Ben David Grabinski, and we are just going to continue our conversation right where we left off last time. Well, before we move off of Archer and Armstrong, look, one question I get asked by people about Sonic a lot, especially people not in the industry. First of all, they assume like Pat and I went and got the rights to Sonic, and it's like Sega's not going to give two random screenwriters the rights to that. That had to be Neil Moritz's company and DJ too. But also the idea of like, you know, oh, what, you know, I think they thought we were like chasing the, like since childhood, we'd wanted to write a Sonic the Hedgehog movie. And every year we kept trying to get it happen. And finally it got going. But that was like, that was an open writing assignment of which we went in and expressed enthusiasm, which was not fake. I'd say Sonic the Hedgehog 2 for the Genesis and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Turtles in Time were probably the two video games I spent the most time playing in my childhood. But the question to you, Ben David, is, because I think you said you weren't really familiar with Archer and Armstrong, the comic, before you went into that. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, I guess where do you kind of fall on that subject? Because I think fans of things always hope, I think rightfully so, in just an objective sense, that the people adapting the things they love are similarly obsessed with it. But the reality of how the industry works is, you know, people are just trying to get jobs. If your agent is like, hey, they're looking for writers for this thing, how do you approach that when it's a property, comic, remake, you know, sequel of something you're not particularly familiar with? What's kind of your first step?
Well, I think being unfamiliar with something is fine. I don't think you should go after something that you hate.
Yeah, I agree.
Sometimes you can watch a movie and it feels like there's contempt for the source material in a way that they're just constantly making fun of it, but in a way that's not funny. Like, there's ways to be self-aware of a thing that you love and ways that aren't. The reality is that the really big stuff, they're not going to send to anybody unless you're really big, or they're being really cheap and don't want to spend any money on someone who's big and don't think that the writing matters. Like, my whole approach to things is like, I don't pitch on something unless I think my idea is like the coolest version of the thing, because I can't do the work unless I love like my approach to it. Like, if I've tried only, I think, once to take a job because it would have been a big job. And I also didn't like my take, but it would have been like great for my career to write it. And it didn't go well because like, I have to like be writing from a point of, oh man, it would be so cool to be sitting in the Dolby Cinema at Burbank 16 and see this scene. Or, oh, it'd be so great to hear the audience laugh at this. Or, oh, this would be so surprising for people. And I think that what you want is people who are enthusiastic and they're aiming their enthusiasm at the thing you love. Like, I just don't know how to do it any other way. And the reality is, like, I've had like a list of dream projects for a long time that I really, really wanted. Like, an example is the Bad Dudes video game. And I had a take on that I really loved. And I got like producers to option the video game and to do this whole thing. And then they couldn't close the rights deal. And I spent like years on that. And there's other things where it's like, that's my dream project. And then you open up the metaphorical trades or the figurative trades of like reading Deadline, and you find out one of your favorite directors is doing it. I mean, that's one of the funnier ones, is that one of the first things I wanted to turn into a movie was Scott Pilgrim when I was like 21. Yeah. And like, I read the book at the same time that like it got announced that Edgar was doing it. And I had just seen like a bootleg of Shaun of the Dead. And you're like, well, I guess that's not going to happen. So sometimes if you live long enough and you're like a cockroach in the apocalypse, something will come back in a different form. But the odds of the thing that you really love being the thing that is going to come across your desk and they're going to want to hire you are so slim. So there's a pragmatic reality to all of it, I think. I mean, I'm still blown away by you guys on the Sonic movies in a way that I don't know if I've ever, if I've either told you 200 times or zero times, I'm not sure which one, because the way this business works is if there's a giant property and there's a movie, 99 times out of 99, the credited writer on it is someone who has a billion credits and they're all hits, or they were like the showrunner of like Alias for seasons, and that's why they got the opportunity to do this thing. There's usually like the barrier of entry for people when they hire someone is, how do I sleep well at night? Did I hire the right person? And some way that they mitigate anxiety is, I hired someone who wrote a hit movie. So the ability to write a hit movie or stay on a hit movie or get sole credit on a movie or close to sole credit on a movie based on a big property is so unbelievably small, because there's all these reasons they come up with not to hire like Akiva Goldsman or the list of like eight guys who do these things. So, and I've met a lot of those guys. I've never met Akiva, so this isn't me like vaguely talking shit about him. And a lot of these guys don't like any of the properties. You know, some of the guys, the guys who are like always on the short list of these big tent poles are like, okay, well, so what is a transformer? Like, what am I doing here? And that's okay. Like, you know, some of the people, they still like find a way in. It's like Tony Gilroy famously was not a big Star Wars guy, and Andor is one of my favorite
things.
I've ever seen in my life. Was that, that answer was not coherent, probably.
No, it was totally coherent. I think you summed it up well, pointing out, because it is, you know, I guess in a perfect world, we're all Quentin Tarantino, and you're just like, what's my next movie going to be? And you think about it and you're like, this one. And then you write it and it gets made and everyone loves it and it wins awards and makes a ton of money. And then you keep repeating that process. The rest of us are all kind of just like, you know, barreling down the rapids, trying to grab onto branches so we can like stay where we are for a second.
I've absolutely given up on that mentality in a way that is really freeing, which is you spend your 20s thinking, this is what I'm going to make when I'm 25. And this is what I'm going to make when I'm 28. And when I'm 32, I want to make this thing. And I think my job is now, if an opportunity lands in my lap, is I just want to do the best job I can at that thing, because it can be, you know, like I spent, you know, forever, like almost 10 years trying to get a movie made that I was going to direct, and then gave up and then wrote happily in like 6 days. And then that movie ended up existing. And I don't know why really, but I do. I guess we should get back on the linear timeline. Or else. Anyway, let's talk about this existential take on the business.
Wait, when was Bad Dudes? Like, what was I used to love that game.
So actually it was in the middle of Archer and Armstrong. I had this idea for Bad Dudes, which I mean, I'm just gonna tell it now, because what the fuck, it's like, yeah. If I spent so long trying to get the rights, and like some of the producers on that were on it, and they joined with some other producers, had a relationship with like, but it was like Data East had the game, but then they went bankrupt and someone bought it out. But my take was, you basically find out in the 80s there was there's something even colder than the Cold War. There was the Ninja War. And at one time, the president did kidnap Ronald Reagan, and the whole thing was completely covered up. But it's not like I didn't really do Ronald Reagan. It was like a fictionalized version of him. And the government had a secret organization in the 80s called like Bad Dudes Protocol, which is that if anything got really, really, really bad, they would call those guys in. So basically, like, these guys kidnapped the president. These ninjas did. The bad dudes rescued him. And then present day, those guys were retired and the program got killed in the 90s, and they're not allowed to tell anyone about what they did. So it's like they're two guys who are like badasses in the 80s, but no one knows if they were ever cool. And then the retired president was like on a book speaking tour, and he still had this like fall if you can't get up button that would like activate that would go to the bad dudes if he ever got kidnapped. So then like, the grandson of like the ninja who kidnapped the president and failed, like to honor his grandpa, decided to kidnap the old president. And then the president pressed the button, and the bad dudes, the retired guys, find out, And instead of calling the cops or telling the government, they decide on their own they're going to go rescue this president before anyone knows he's been kidnapped. And then they create an international incident. So it was basically like The Expendables meets Grumpy Old Men, but with ninjas and stuff. I'm probably being too self-deprecating because it was fucking cool. but I would like wanted to do that thing where you get like your old favorite 80s action stars, and then you have like the younger guys in the flashbacks playing the 80s versions of themselves. And I broke the whole story, and I was really excited about it. And then I just could never figure out the rights. Like, I had people who were willing to spend the money on the rights and pay me to write it, but it was just a really complicated legal
situation. A bunch of different entities own it.
Yeah, and then you're also have to deal with like an international corporation and the way that they handle their options. And a lot of times it's very different. Like, I'm very naive about this still, even though I made like an anime, but there are some situations like where you kind of only have like a temporary option that's like a verbal handshake deal. And there's like people you have to clear things through, and their process is way different here, where everyone here wants to like own the rights in perpetuity. You know, if they're going to be spending any money on something, and all of it's a mess. I'm glad I'm not a lawyer.
If I'm in the 80s, I loved ninja movies. Like, I always thought they were kind of like reverse slashers, where the ninja would just have all, like, Revenge of the Ninja is a slasher movie. It's just a reverse slasher where he's using all these weird diabolical weapons on the mobsters in that building. And when Ninja Assassin came out, I was so hyped. I was like, the ninja movies are coming back. Then he had the two Scott Atkins ninja movies, and that just died.
Man, Ninja 2 is so sick. I love Scott Atkins.
That's awesome.
How can anyone be 10 years old now and not have ninja content? Like, there was such an important part of being 10 years old was things with ninjas in them. Like, a ninja star was the coolest thing in the world when you're 10. And what do these kids have now? I mean, the new Ninja Turtles looks great, but
I feel like the problem is that, you know, that generation who grew up on ninjas actually ultimately ruined it for future generations when they reached adulthood. Because we went through that phase in like the aughts where ninjas were hilarious, you know, it was like ninjas, Bigfoot, just all, you know, Dr. McNinja, and, you know, which were funny, but I think there was just kind of a glut of that thing. So the idea of even attempting to do a serious ninja thing maybe now strikes people as bizarre.
Did Beverly Hills Ninja like ruin it? Would my movie have ruined ninjas? I don't know. I will not.
Your ninjas weren't ironic, though.
Well, yeah, the ninjas, my idea of the ninjas is that they were incredibly serious, and then the guys fighting them were kind of buffoons. So that sort of felt like you'd have action scenes where these guys are kind of over the hill, but the threat was incredibly scary, you know? Like, I just, you know, as a kid, I thought there's that thing where just someday ninjas might, like, descend from the ceiling from, like, ropes and then jump through windows and kidnap you at any moment, and that was awesome.
Well, Beverly Hills Ninja originally was going to be Jackie Chan and Chris Farley, but then they couldn't get Jackie Chan, and then they got the dude from Mortal Kombat. So I think it would have been a totally different movie. Well, I thought Ninja Assassin had great concepts too in that movie. It had Shokasugi in it, which was rad. And
I just remember seeing that at like a midnight screening at Comic-Con, and then J. Michael Straczynski said in an interview that like he wrote the script in a weekend, and I'm like, it feels like you wrote the script in a weekend.
Yeah,
but the funny thing about that is I was sitting next to some agents who, if I remember correctly, they introduced themselves to me before that screening, and they're like, we represent the second unit directors on this, who we think are going to be huge directors someday. And it was
Leech and... Yeah, they were right. All right, Steve. So that did fall perfectly in the timeline.
Yeah, no more. All right, no more ninja talk. Ninja 2 is pretty cool because Scott Atkins fights King Kasugi, and I love King Kasugi. So anyway,
I love that you had
part 3 of this podcast will just about me talking about how I saw Ninja 2.
I was going to say that Steve tried to move on from ninjas, but had a final thought he had to say. All right. What's next on the timeline, Steve?
Any reason to bring up Kane Kasugi, dude? Enormous was next.
So I directed a pilot for Machinima that literally does not exist.
Like, it's not viewable anywhere, you mean?
Yeah, I don't know what happened with Machinima, man. But, like, I directed a pilot for them, and then so much of their content is just nowhere on the internet. And I... came on and replaced another director, and it'd been like years since I made my short at the time, and I kept getting close to directing a movie, and then someone called me and offered it to me, and I'm like, oh well, yeah, I want to direct something again, so I'll do that. And it was a very strange experience because I was trying to make something that didn't really have a sense of humor, and that's not really my thing. But then I also had Joe Swanberg and Simon Barrett were in it, and I was like trying to give them funny stuff to do, and Todd Farmer was in it, and my friend Nathan, and I was the first person I believe to cast Charles Melton, who is now like a big actor, and at the time he was just a really handsome young person, so every time I see him and stuff I'm like, I discover that guy. And by that, I mean, I put him in a pilot that not only didn't get picked up to series, that literally no one can see and is probably not on his resume. So by discover him, I mean, I didn't, but I knew guy would be big. He was way too handsome to not be successful. But yeah, so I made that and I had a good time making it. And then it just sort of vanished. Most of my memories of making that are cutting it with Josh Ethier at Adam Green's like production company and like something. Yeah, it was a good time making it, and now it doesn't exist. So
what was the premise of that?
So it was based on a comic book, and it was in a world that had been overrun by gigantic monsters.
Is that the Steve Niles comic?
No,
that's gigantic.
Yeah. This guy Tim Daniel, and he was a producer on it, and they had optioned it, so I made a pilot of that, and then Fox bought it from the same producers to make a pilot for a network show, which no one asked me to come on. but then that didn't end up going to series, so there was like a bunch of iterations of that thing.
And I guess it was written by the guy who Troll Hunter, that's what I see here, one of the writers, is that true? I don't
know. Norwegian?
Yeah, it says.
So he was the director who I replaced. I didn't
know. Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I see. He had to drop off to do something, and then I jumped on, and he had written a script that I did a very like minor, like just to change some of the dialogue, and like move something from like a hospital to an abandoned building. But yeah, that was supposed to be a thing he was doing, and I have no clue what happened there.
All right, cool. And then in March 2016, I see an announcement for Bravado.
Yeah, so that was a spec that I sold with Andrew Lazar producing that was supposed to be the start of like a big action franchise that, as you may have noticed, has not been made. But the premise was about a soldier who came back from war and decided to become a cop, and then basically realized that cops had become militarized, and he was trying to get away from that, and he ends up finding out like his whole department are actually criminals. And the idea I had, it's like, what if the guys from Heat that were robbing banks were actually just the whole department of like a big city, and the guy who comes in as this war hero realizes that people around him are corrupt, and then when he doesn't want to become corrupt, it becomes like this one guy versus a police department. And it changed so much that I literally cannot even remember what the latest version of it was, but it's one of those things where we sold it, and then after they sold it, the deal literally took 18 months to close, and then by the time it closed, there was new execs on it, and then it became one of those, well, hey, but what if it was this, and we do like this thing, but what if we rewrote it to try to get this actor, and I don't. It's just one of those things where like there was so many iterations of like, oh, it's about a guy who's like dad was a police chief, but then he came home and he died. No, it was this guy and his brother did this thing. And I don't even remember what it was anymore. All I know is at the time I wanted it to be sort of like The Rock's character in Fast Five taking down a police department. Love corrupt dudes and part of it was like, I remember seeing the trailer for SWAT and wishing the whole movie was what I thought it was going to be, which is it made it look like it's going to be like Black Hawk Down in like a downtown area where it's like one guy's like, I'll pay you $100 million to rescue me. And I'm like, this whole movie is going to be like all these people warring and blowing things up and firing rockets at each other. And then it ends up being like 2 minutes of the movie, you know? but that really, I sometimes what I write is just what I was hoping a movie would be, but ended up being a different thing. And I think my original intention of that was just, I wanted to write the movie that I thought SWAT was going to be based on the trailer.
It's a good system.
There's some stuff that I've done that I can't admit for a long time is purely just a reaction to me thinking a movie is going to be one thing and it wasn't. So I'm like, well, I'll write the thing I thought it was.
I hate it when trailers do that. I thought the SWAT trailer was cool too. I remember when I went to go see The Negotiator, the fucking trailer made it look like Kevin Spacey and who was the other cat in that movie?
Sam Jackson?
Yeah, it looked like they were going to team up at the ending and do some action shit. And I went to go see it in the theater. I'm like, oh, these guys are just talking the whole time.
I literally saw Brian Collins give that 3.5 stars on Letterboxd this morning and say he wishes they made more movies like it. And all I can ever think about Negotiator is seeing that trailer a bunch of times and having it ruin the ending and thinking the same thing. It's like, it's a whole movie about a hostage negotiator and this guy teaming up. And then it's like, no, that's the twist. That's like the turn later. So they sold me on the movie that was actually you're waiting for the movie to be. Like when marketing departments spoil things, they think, oh, we need to get them in the seats so they'll like, no, it's worth seeing. But then if you're just waiting the whole movie for it to become the thing that you were sold on, it doesn't work for me or America. I don't know.
That's why I don't watch trailers anymore. I watch them after I see the movie. I can't do it. It's just, they upset me.
But I love getting hyped, man. Like that's the problem is I love watching a trailer.
Yeah,
and, like,
I love trailers.
Tom Cruise just went off a mountain. I actually saw a movie the other day. I didn't even realize Josh was in there. And I was telling somebody afterwards, it's like, it's the first thing I'd seen in a while where like every trailer, I was like, I want to see that movie. Like, I didn't even know that the divorce, one of the divorced Coen brothers, like his movie was even had a trailer out yet. And there's all these
I didn't even know he was working on something.
That was my favorite thing is that when the other guy made Macbeth or whatever, the party line was, oh, well, you know, they didn't break up. The other guy just doesn't want to make movies anymore. And then like 2 weeks after they said that, they announced his movie. It's like, get on the same page about your PR thing, guys.
Brothers. All right, Steve, what do we got?
Bloody Hell.
Bloody Hell is a movie that I wrote at the same time I made Cost of Living. And I spent forever trying to direct. And I have now finally given up. But I really loved it. It was like a dream movie for me. And the premise was basically Romancing the Stone, except Kathleen Turner wrote Twilight. And she finds out vampires are real and they send assassins to kill her because this thing that she made up ended up being the real way to kill vampires. And she just made it up as a goof. So they assume she must know all their secrets. And they send this Michael Douglas type dude after her. But instead of killing her, he's like, all right, well, if you pay me, I'll keep you alive. So it was her, the author, and this vampire, drunken vampire assassin on the run from vampire assassins. And then they fall in love. And then unravel like a big conspiracy. And her book was called Bloody Hell. And I spent a long time trying to get that made, but there was no way to make it cheaply because there's like a 20-page car chase in the middle. So it was like one of those things where the cheapest way you could do it is if like you went to South Africa and then did XYZ and it was still going to be like 25 million. And
yeah.
It took me almost a decade to realize that no one was going to give me 25 million when I hadn't made a movie, which is why I ended up writing happily. But I just never gave up on it and then gave up on it.
Well, that's a cool concept. That's maybe that's what you needed to do for it to finally come back.
Well, the funny thing though, is there's just a movie that premiered at some festival recently called Bloody Hell. And I'm like, I can never lose my title. And I get upset about those things. It's like, even when it's nothing, but like, I still can't believe they called Neighbors Neighbors. Like, I love everybody who made that movie, and I love that movie. I even love the sequel, and I don't even like the 80s movie Neighbors, but when you call a movie the title of another movie, I just feel like there are other words, man.
Well, did that start? I'm not sure. I didn't look it up because we just talked about it now. Was that supposed to be a remake of that 80s movie?
No, it had no title, and it was just one of those things where they had a great premise, great script, great cast. And then they end up figuring out the only title I guess probably marketed well or tested well was The Neighbors. And it was a great title because they're neighbors, you know. But for me, my brain is just like, you're just trying to cancel out this other movie, bro.
Like how dare you disrespect Belushi?
Like, how is there a fucking show called Face Off where whenever I want to Google cool images for my favorite action movie, I have to see this show called Face Off? Like, come on, guys.
Rude.
The Neighbors 80s movie has a fascinating making of history.
Yeah.
Almost all of those do. And it's usually one word, cocaine.
Cocaine. So I feel like it's also, was that another one where Dan Aykroyd turned in like a 500-page script that they had to like find the movie hidden inside?
I mean, I only know that of Blues Brothers and Ghostbusters, but those are my favorite things, which is like he's giving you too many ingredients for a cake, and then the job is this race against time to just figure out the bare minimum ingredients you need.
Yeah.
And I guess he's cool with it, but I really wish that would be a dream for me. And I did have a similar situation on something that I probably won't bring up here, but where someone gives you just too much and your job is to just get it down to like
find the good stuff. Yeah.
That there is something really fun about having a thing that has too many good things, because usually you have something that's not, but it's like the Ghostbusters and Blues Brothers scripts, like if they shot them would be longer than Until the End of the World. Which would be cool. I mean, I would watch a 5-hour Ghostbusters movie, but my fear would be it would be like one of those unrated mid-2000s comedy DVDs that just like endless jokes.
I was going to say the like Satan Tango version of the Blues Brothers.
Man, I mean, that movie is fantasy. So,
yeah, I never watched the Stripes extended cut, but I heard people tell me, don't watch it. It's going to ruin the movie for you. But I hear
that's. I mean, I feel like we all fell in love with the concept of director's cuts back in the day with like Blade Runner and Touch of Evil. But more often than not, there's a reason, you know, movies get edited down.
The problem is there's only a couple of guys who are good at it. But the reality is that in most cases, you have no objectivity anymore and you don't know how an audience responded to something. So you don't need to add like an animated comic book intro to a movie that was already perfect, you know, or you don't need to add this extended scene right away. It's like if someone took my favorite song and then added a verse in the middle, I'm like, I don't know.
I didn't need this.
I guess I'll try to get back on track, but that's not my job. I'm not the host.
Steve.
Yeah, that's me. All right, I'm back.
pretty incredible.
Yeah, I'm back. Are You Afraid of the Dark? So so that was going to be a movie, but you were working on the show.
That's all backwards. So what happened was,
okay, yeah, you know better. I don't know.
So these producers wanted to make Happily. This guy Brian Duffield had given my script to these producers he was working with, and they reached out and they're like, hey, we want to make Happily. And then for some reasons they decided not to, or I might have just realized that I wanted to keep the movie really weird and inaccessible. So I think I might have taken it back from that. I don't remember, but it was a good situation where like we all got along. And when that happened, they brought me this horror book that Paramount had optioned, and I had a take on it and I really liked it, and they made a deal to do it. And while we were working on that, they were working on an Are You Afraid of the Dark movie. And this guy, Gary Dauberman, had written a draft. He was like this really, really, really talented, big deal horror writer. This guy I've known as like a really good dude. He was like doing, I think he was writing like It 2 or something. And in meetings, they were talking about it, about how like different ideas they wanted to explore for the movie and things that they wanted to do. And they were saying something about the show. And I was like, yeah, it's one of my favorite shows of all time. Like I was obsessed with it as a kid. And they're like, yeah, you should read the script. And I read it, and it wasn't a situation at all where I was pitching on it or like they were even meeting with people to rewrite. I think they were meeting with directors. And then the producers asked me about it. And I basically said something where there was a twist at the end of the first act. And I had said, well, when I was reading it, I thought this thing was going to happen. And they're like, oh, that's interesting. And I was not pitching on it. And then we just started talking. And then they like told their boss stuff that I had said. And then like really quickly, someone was like, hey, do you want to like do a draft of this? And I wrote like incredibly quickly like a new version of kind of the same concept. And
you wrote a script or like a treatment
for the movie? Like they paid me to do a draft, and I was like really, really happy with it, and the process went really well. And then a bunch of directors met on it, and then a guy got hired to do it, and then as soon as he got the job, he fired me. So I found out that I'd been fired from the movie. And literally the same day, I got a call about Nickelodeon was going to do a TV show based on it. And they had really liked my draft. And like, do you have any ideas for a show? And I was like, Yes, I do. I would love to do it. But I was in pre-production on Happily, and I was going to be shooting in like a month. And they're like, okay, great. Well, we want to hear a concept, and then we're going to need the scripts in like 3 months. And I didn't tell anybody I was making a movie. And I pitched this idea, and my whole idea was like an aliens in an Area 51 thing. And then they're like, okay, we're going to have you do a show, but we don't want aliens in it, and we want you to come up with something new. And I'd worked on this movie Blind Spotting with Raphael Cassel, and my idea was, oh, I want to do like a evil traveling carnival show with a big charismatic bad guy, and it should be Rafa. And I think I pitched it like over text with somebody, and then like told a brief version, and then they're like, oh, this is great. So we're gonna make a 3-episode show, and we need you to like have the scripts ready and fit in March or something. And I was like a week away from shooting. So I was like making Happily while I was writing the show. And then when I wrapped, I wrote like episode 2 and 3 in like a week after I like wrapped the movie. So that was like one of the most insane years of my life because I was writing the Are You Afraid of the Dark movie in August for like a few months. And then Happily got greenlit before winter, and then I was writing the Are You Afraid of the Dark show and then directing my first movie. And then I finished writing the scripts as we started editing the movie. And as soon as I locked edit, I flew to Vancouver to shoot the show. And then that was in post while I was like finishing Happily. So like I made my first movie and my first TV show at the same time, which I would not recommend for anybody at all. And I really liked the movie, but I think the success of the show might have killed the
Killed the
movie.
movie.
Yeah. So, and then I had to quit season 2 of Are You Afraid of the Dark because I got another show, which was that. So Rafa, like brought me on a thing, and then I got hired to be the showrunner of a show because Michael Waldron had left to do Loki, who had originally written a pilot that we like sold to USA and Peacock. And then it was like with Soderbergh, who's like my fucking hero. And it was like a big, fancy Elmore Leonard style kind of thriller that's really, it was also really funny. It was called Florida Man at the time. And I got sent to New Orleans for prep. And then this is March 2020. And we found out that Tom Hanks had this weird new fancy ailment and the NBA got shut down. And then the next day I got sent home for quote unquote 2 weeks temporarily, but they were going to send me back. And then that show did not get made. So I left Are You Afraid of the Dark to make a show that got killed by COVID. And then the show just kept going. So that was a weird experience.
I mean, it is funny that because we started this podcast before COVID. And so, usually the number one or number two reason any project didn't happen is either, executive change up, or the financing fell through slash it turned out that people never had the rights in the first place. So it's been interesting now, how often things, COVID killed it has kind of become the number one new reason things
You
didn't
could make a
happen.
whole podcast out of like movies or TV shows that didn't get made because of that. It's a brand new adventure for why a thing doesn't exist. That I still can't get over that experience. That was just the to have. So I my premiere for Happily was supposed to be at Tribeca, and I'll never forget. I'm sitting. We're on a scout. Deadline says Tribeca's canceled, and everyone on the show spends
All
about
right.
two hours like being really nice to me, like, "Hey, how are you doing, Ben David? Oh, I know you're really excited about your premiere." And like, I'd spent weeks carving out this thing so our shooting schedule was arranged around the premiere at Tribeca, where we were gonna have like a day off of the shooting, so I could fly to New York, go to my premiere, come back to finish shooting this pilot. And there's like 2 hours of people being really nice to me because they feel bad. And then 2 hours later, we get a call that our show is dead. So we went from this transition of like, I was the center of attention for like empathy, and I was like this sad little puppy dog. And then we were all the sad little puppy dog. So it was just a weird day. It was like the exact same day. I'll never forget it. Premiere killed, show gets killed. And then we're all like in Orlando on this scout, just like, are we coming back? What are we, should we be wearing masks? And I remember somebody on the production who I will not name stole a, we couldn't get any antibacterial, like from like any, it was sold out everywhere. So this guy was in a bathroom and they had one of those things, you know, where you press it.
Yeah.
Broke it open and then just took it all and put it in his bag. No one, we couldn't find any in Orlando at the time.
Oh, man, that's some post-apocalyptic shit right there.
But some of my producers had made the movie Contagion. So I just remember sitting in a scouting van with people who had made Contagion, calling their consultants from that movie to be like, what's going on here?
You're like, uh-oh.
And then one of the guys just kept saying, when people would say something, he's like, listen, I made Contagion. So what we need to talk about is, whenever we were having meetings about whether or not our show would get shut down.
When they sent you home for 2 weeks, like, did you assume that it would only be 2 weeks, or did you kind of know?
Well, this is the true story. If you ask anybody on it, I think they'll back me up, is that we had like 20 people there doing all these scouts and stuff in New Orleans. And I was the one who kept saying, hey guys, I don't want to be that guy, but don't we think we're all probably going to get sent home? And everyone looked at me like I was nuts. And I was like, okay, fine. I guess I'm just being negative. And then stuff would happen to me planning. And I'd say, yeah, but what do we do if we like shut this down? And then it was like this thing where it went from me being like this idiot who was just like pessimistic to being like, then it did happen. And everyone sort of looked at me kind of like, you fucker. Like, it was just the more everyone around me seemed confident that it'd be fine, the more I convinced myself it would be fine. But I remember the first person who was like, this is all going to be dead, was Jack Black, because, and I didn't believe it. I'll never forget it. It's like when we got announced in like February or something, and I emailed him. I was like, hey, we're going to premiere at Tribeca. And he was a producer on Happily. And I was like, do you want to introduce the movie? He's like, yeah. He's like, you know, assuming it's all still going to happen. I remember being like, why wouldn't it happen? He's like, well, COVID. And I'm like, what?
COVID.
Why would that stop a film? What are we talking about? And there's a very, very first person who was like the canary in the coal mine for me. It was like early
wisdom of Jack Black.
Yeah. Just, he was just very plugged in. He's like, hey, I'll introduce it if it still happens. And then it didn't happen.
That sucks.
COVID.
But yeah, Are You Afraid of the Dark was one of those things where I'm super stoked about the show, and no one can see it, but I have, like, the poster behind me. I can't believe it exists, and it's crazy that it just keeps going, and it's the weirdest thing to be like, it just still exists. And that other show doesn't, and I'm like, right now, everything I'm working on, I'm really stoked about, and it's weird how everything comes around, where someone could listen to this in 5 years and this won't mean anything because it, you know, you never know if something will actually happen. But like the movie I'm supposed to direct soon, that I'm really excited about, is because the producer Buddy Hell, which never got made, Andrew Lazar, we'd spent like 10 years trying to get that made, and it just never really happened. But I had such a good experience working with him, even though it didn't happen. And he is 100% the reason the movie right now is up and going and set up at a studio and stuff. And the weirdest thing about the job is that the stuff that doesn't work out can still lead to other things, or like the relationships from them all still kind of matter, unless you burn all the bridges, which, you know, is also an option. But yeah, it's like all the things, a lot of the good stuff is the result of the bad stuff, but that doesn't make the stuff not happening less shitty, I guess.
For sure. No, I mean, yeah, if you're doing it right, paths start to, well, first of all, you got to keep that path still going, and they start to intersect, often in helpful ways, sometimes not in helpful ways. But I think, as you just said, living proof of that.
Yeah, it's like you just, it just sucks, and it's good. And sometimes it's great, and sometimes it's bad. That's my take.
Sometimes there's a global pandemic.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, not to put the spotlight back on you, but it's like, if you look back at where you were, like around the same time when you first got to LA and the stuff you're doing, like, does any of the path really lead to Sonic the Hedgehog trilogy? You know,
I mean, that has like its own super bizarre stepping stone paths that start with the movie Hey Stop Stabbing Me that Pat and I made when we were 20 in college. But in part, our mutual friend Keith Calder had found that on one of, like, it was either Elliot or Rocio had their own website that had like a popular wordplay.
That was a good website.
Keith would frequent that message board, and someone was hyping Hey Stop Stabbing Me on that, so we bought a copy of the DVD and somehow tracked us down, because I think we still had a website at the time that I had my email address on, and like that was a path, and the people ran that website something awful that unfortunately spawned 4chan, but I don't think they can be blamed for that. But they reached out because of Hey Stop Stabbing Me, and then like those two paths, like over a decade later, kind of intersected in interesting ways. So as you kind of, if you survive long enough, usually things start to kind of circle back.
Well, there's a deadline announcement for something of mine recently, and a comment was from, if it's really him, from a guy who's like a showrunner of like this big superhero show, and he was like, oh, I know that guy from a message board like 15 years ago. Good for him. And I'm like, wait, what message board? How did I know you? I don't remember any of this. What? The long timeline of things, or why you know people, or people who remember you, but you don't remember them. It's all chaos. But it kind of can add up to something.
And I guess the moral there is hang in there.
Is there a moral to anything? I don't know. As I sit here in this perfect moment of being permanently banned from Twitter, and maybe I'll end up back, you know, there's an existential crisis in and of itself from there. What is the business going to be in 2 years versus what it was 10 years ago? I think the only thing that is makes sense to me is that you can only do this because you really love movies, or you really love this shit, because if you don't, it feels like it's probably a really annoying business to be in.
Oh yeah. I mean, I feel like I can't even take any credit for hanging in there, because that's not, I never even viewed it that way. I was like, I don't know how to do anything else. Like, I have a film studies degree. What am I going to, you know, I have no marketable skills beyond this.
I got fired from Best Buy, Wendy's, Sam's Club, dining services in college. I got fired from a telemarketing job in college. I got fired from like everything that I did besides this. So I'd be really fucked. Otherwise, I am not capable of doing the other things.
They wouldn't hire me at Arclight movie theaters. I'm still baffled by that.
Oh man, if I got into a list of all the things that I have a chip on my shoulder that like I could not get. I remember like right before I sold a script and my career started, I could not get an internship at like a million places to save my life. I had like applied at hundreds of places, and no one would even, for an internship, no one even replied to me. And then my script got optioned while I was in the middle of trying to do that, and it was the weirdest experience for me. I'm like, why? Okay, people pay me for screenplay, no one will not pay me for job. What is happening here? How do these things connect? I don't know.
You picked the right career path.
Well, what's the worst way that we could end this? What else could I say that is seemingly funny but actually nihilistic? I don't know. What do we do?
I don't know. I don't know.
I gotta say, this is all worth it for the point when you're like, "And I'm back."
And I'm back. No, I actually thought Are You Afraid of the Dark started off as a show and was going to be spun off into the movie. I had that completely wrong.
Well, there is no normal process for it, because like no one says the way to get your first TV show is to get a job writing another movie based on a horror book, but then the rights fall apart, but you coincidentally were a fan of this other property they had, but the original writer was too busy because he's doing another thing, but then the director fires you the same day that another corporate entity decides to make a TV show of the same property, and you just had the heads up because you've been doing the movie instead of them meeting with other TV show runners. Like, that's not, that's not like a path that makes sense at all from the outside or inside. It's not something that can like really be replicated. It makes more sense on the outside that maybe they're developing a movie while the show was happening. But I wish the movie existed. I think that things could exist simultaneously, because I sort of thought the movie should have been in like a very hard PG-13 world, and then the show would be for 10-year-olds. That's what I would do if I was the Kevin Feige of Are You Afraid of the Dark? You know, like you have like something that was like the tone of a Blumhouse movie, but you know, with a family adventure vibe, but close to rated R. And then the kids one you could like show your 10-year-olds. But you know, but maybe they'll still do it someday. And I'm always down when someone gives me a call. Like I have there's another Are You Afraid of the Dark thing I did that I can't talk about that will probably get announced soon for Nickelodeon, but it's not the show. So like, I still like all the people who are making that. I like what they're doing, and I hope they make a bunch of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I was going to say is that it was announced in like 2017. And then I guess they were aiming for an October 2019 premiere for the movie. And is that when the show premiered?
Which part was 2017? Cause I started writing it in August 2018. So,
oh, okay. That's
so you're probably looking at the Dauberman version.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's the Dauberman version was announced in 2017. And then they wanted to release it on October, the movie to be released in October 2019.
Yeah. Like Gary wrote like it and then was like writing an Annabelle movie to direct. And then he wrote that. And it was just like, I think just somewhere in the middle of him being way too successful, someone asked me to do stuff. But yeah, because his Annabelle movie came out while I was shooting. I saw that in Vancouver while I was shooting the show. So yeah, the only thing I know is that I was writing that in August 2018.
Okay. Yeah, and then in February 2019, it was removed from the 2019 release schedule. So I'm guessing, as what you said, it was because the show was then greenlit.
Yeah, the show was greenlit. Like, yeah, that's exactly when it was greenlit. And like they were like meeting with directors then, and I was like finishing writing 2 and 3 in February. So that makes sense.
I was figuring it was going to be an anthology, but it was just going to be like a one story then. Like the Tales from the Crypt movie was.
Well, that was my take of the show. As I came in, I'm like, it has to be an anthology. And they said, no. I said, well, it has to be about the kids who tell the stories. And they go, okay. Because, so like the reason why I still have developed by credit on like all the other stuff that they're doing now is because I was the first person to make like the show about the kids. Like they had some later episodes of the original show that like followed the kids who are in the group. But for me, I'm like, if I can't do an anthology, what I want to do is make a show about kids who find community from loving horror. Like that was my way into it emotionally. Cause as a kid, I wish someone would ask me to join the Midnight Society. So that was like kind of my way into the show was, well, I wanted to make it about someone who finds out it exists and gets asked to join, but then horror ends up being real. So like the show now, all the iterations of it are about the Midnight Society, not about the stories they're telling. Like they have stories they tell within it, but now it's like, they are the A plot of the thing. It's like if Rod Serling, that they rebooted Twilight Zone, but it was about Rod Serling, I guess. You know, the guy who's introducing the show. It sounds really dumb when you put it that way, but
sounds great.
All right, well, this was a great 2-hour podcast. I hope you split it into four parts. I hope this is like the Beyond the Spider-Verse portion of it that you're hearing right now.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right, well, I love this podcast. You guys are great. And thank you for having me on it.
Thank you for sharing all these stories.
All right. And that concludes our conversation with Ben David Grabinski. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben David. And thank you to you, the listeners, for listening. You can find us on social media, and we highly recommend that you join our Patreon. You'll not only be supporting the podcast so we can keep going forever and ever until the sun goes red giant and kills us all. And you get bonus content, us talking movie recommendations, extra long conversations with some of our guests, and themed episodes as well, talking about box office or maybe particular filmmakers we're obsessed with and just want to shine a light on. We like to think it is good stuff and the kind of stuff we can never talk about at length on our show because it has nothing to do with an unmade movie. Until next time, this is Josh Miller and
Steven Scarlatta
saying we won't see you at the movies.